Now, David had gone to Gath, seeking to escape Saul. Obviously, Saul couldn't follow him into the Philistine territory. These are two nations that had, an ongoing protracted war going on, between these two nations. And there was not a mountain range or a river or anything that separated them. The Philistine territory is on the coastal plain. Judea is primarily in the hills, but it's sort of melds where they come together. The frontier would shift back and forth, so you don't have a hard and fast territorial difference between the two. And David had gone to Gath, and this is the thing that's almost mind-boggling. He's so afraid of Saul, and I think that David made a mistake here, and I think he realizes it after he got there. He's got the sword of Goliath with him, and where does he go? He goes to Goliath's hometown. And he shows up, and of course there would be some measure of reverence for David because of his great ability, but at the same time, here is their chief enemy. And, with the trophy from killing their hero. And so, he gets afraid after he's there, and it says, in verse 13 of chapter 21, the end of the chapter there, he says he changed his behavior before them and feigned himself mad. He pretended he was out of his mind in their hands, and he scrabbled on the doors of the gates and let his drool come down his beard. And then said Achish unto his servants, "Lo, you see the man is mad. Where brought him? What do I need crazy people here for? Do I have need of madmen that you brought this fellow to play the madman in my presence? He should not come into my house. Get this guy out of here." And David, therefore, it says in verse 1 of chapter 22, departed thence and escaped. And he goes to the cave Adullam. We're not sure where this is. This is in southern Judah. In Israel, the mountains, the hilly country, the sort of, you know, we think mountains like this, but it's pretty, you know, there's a lot of up and down in the country there. The mountains that run down the middle of the nation are limestone. And what do you get when you have limestone? You get caves. Limestone is water soluble over a period of time, and as streams and springs and stuff run down through the rocks, it ends up excavating caves. This is why, for example, Kentucky has so many caves, is because Kentucky sits basically on a giant slab of limestone. And so you have a lot of caves in Israel. And in ancient times, they used to use these for a number of purposes. They would, because it's drier than it is in Kentucky, they would expand these things. There would be dirt on the floor, and they would use these for shelter for the sheep and so on while they're out. And of course, sheep being in there is going to level the floor a little bit. And so you had these caves. Well, this is where this is David's stomping grounds. This is, where he was a shepherd, and he would know about these places. And so he flees from the Philistine territory, and he goes to the cave of Adullam, and it's evidently a fairly large cave. We don't know how big the opening is, but it's out in the middle of nowhere. If you got this, rough vertical country, that's not where they put the villages. They put the villages and the cities and so on a hill right adjacent to or in the middle of a valley, because you'd have your agricultural ground and then your village. If you go out into the hills and stuff, that is not generally where they had the villages and cities. So this is in a remote area. This is in at least semi-desert area. If you have seen pictures of what the hill country of Judea looks like, it is very barren. You've got tussocks of grass and a few bushes here and there, but it's almost devoid of trees. There's not enough rain to grow anything. This is drier than much of Southern California. And so he goes to this cave. And when his brethren and all his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him. This is probably not terribly far from Bethlehem, probably within 10 miles or less. And it says in verse 2, and everyone that was in distress and everyone that was in debt and everyone that was discontented, which means that he was in anguish of soul, gathered themselves unto him, and he became a captain over them. So, he's He's got an interesting bunch of guys that have gravitated to him. This is the sort of group that there may be some good and noble men among them, but generally you've got a bunch of ne'er-do-wells here. And to be in a position of leadership to keep this kind of group under control and in a unified whole to work together requires some measure of leadership. Now, David's already demonstrated leadership. He's been a general in the army. He has been a leader of men. And here he is. He's still in his 20s here. He's in his mid-20s. He's probably about 25 at this time, maybe. And because we know it's going to be at least probably about another three or four years before he comes to the throne, at least. And so he's in his mid-20s. And so all these people gather to him. He becomes a captain over them, about 400 men. We find out later on they have their families with them. So we had, you know, at least 1,000 people who have gravitated to him. They don't have a town. They're just sort of this roaming mob of people. And David went thence to Mizpah of Moab. Moab is, by the way, where Ruth came from. Ruth was David's... what, great-grandmother, I think it was? Or great-great-grandmother? And so there may be, you know, we don't think about this. He says, where do your ancestors come from? Well, I think they come from such and such and such and such. You know, they came from Scotland, they came from England, they came from Russia, they came from Poland, they came from whatever, Lithuania. But that's sort of a little bit of family history, but we don't have, for the most part, a connection with that other than just a point of remembrance or maybe how our last name is spelled. But in most parts of the world, if you come from a particular place, that stays with you for generations. That there's a connection there. You don't have the hodgepodge that we have here in this country. We're a nation of immigrants. And that's not the way it is in most parts of the world. So David goes thence to Mizpah of Moab. Now, I'm under the impression, because he's not there very long, that the whole crew didn't go with him. That this huge bunch of people that have been following him didn't go with him, that he went himself maybe with just a handful of people. And he does something very noble here. Remember, he's a wanted man. And Saul will stop at nothing, as we will see very shortly. Saul will stop at nothing to get David. Saul has popped a spring. He is not in his right mind. He is driven by self and self-preservation. And people who are of that mindset will do the most amazing things. Other people's lives don't matter. It's themselves. And so murder and a number of other things are going to take place in at the hand of Saul. And it's because David knows this, or at least suspects this, he goes to Moab, and he said to the king of Moab, let my father and my mother, I pray thee, come forth and be with you till I know what God will do for me. Now, when David was a boy, when he went to slay Goliath, it says that his father was recognized as an old man at that time. And 10 years have passed. 8, 10 years have passed. And so, you know, Jesse and his wife can't be following David traipsing over the hills and so on. He's got to, you know, mom and dad just, you know, they can't handle the the rigor of this kind of life. I got to put them someplace where they'll be safe. And they're not going to be safe here in Judea. And so I've got to send them to another place. We've been at war with the Philistines, but we've got an old family connection with Moab. Moab is the territory east of the Dead Sea. So it's south and east on the other side of Jordan. And it's outside of Israelite territory. And so, at this point, there's no conflict. And there hasn't been one for a while. They've had war with the Ammonites early in Saul's reign, and they've got the ongoing war with the Philistines. But there hasn't been anything recently with the Moabites. So, go down to Moab and, have mom and dad stay there. And he brought them unto the king of Moab, and they dwelt with him all the time that David was in the hold. All the time that David was on the run from Saul in various strongholds and caves hiding out in the hills of southern Judea. His parents were there with the king of Moab. In verse 5 it says, and the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold. Don't stay here in this cave. And get thee into the land of Judah. Now the cave of Adullam is probably, because he says get into Judah, it's probably on the front, near the frontier between the Philistine territory and Israel, Judah in particular. And so he gets a message from God via the prophet Gad and says, get up into Judah. And so he goes up into the forest of Hereth. Now, we have forests here. Go out hiking. You know, you can go out to, I like going, we did some hiking at Pack Forest earlier this this spring. I like to go up to Federation Forest. If you want some old growth that's easy to get to, go up to Federation Forest between Enumclaw and Greenwater. Some easy trails. I think there's 2 square miles of or more of old growth forest. You know, the stuff that goes up 250 feet and you got trees like this. It's, you know, it's really impressive stuff. That isn't the kind of forest we have here. When I've been in California, when I was in California this past spring, I went on a couple of different hikes. And one of the hikes I went on was in a forest. But it was a central Southern California forest, which means I've got these gnarly trees that a really big one is like, you know, 30 feet tall. It's older than the firs and stuff growing up here in Federation Forest. It might be this big around, but it's only, you know, 30 feet tall maybe. And they're further apart because they're competing for water and they got some thorny brush growing on the ground. Okay, that's a forest in that area. He's in a hilly area, where ravines where the water runs down, and so you got some of this, dense tangled forest, there in the ravines, and that's where he goes. And that's where he's gonna be hiding. And so he's there for a while. David is learning to lead men. He has learned that experience. We have to understand, when we're going through hardship, when we're going through difficulty, when we're going through trials, this is very often training for something we're gonna get later on. And it isn't one of those things that we really relish. If it was up to us, we'd take a different route. Isn't there a simpler, easier way? No, this is exactly what you need. Because God is decreeing, this is exactly what you need. And David is learning hardship. David is learning difficulty. He is learning compassion with others who have been in difficult situations. He's up till this point, everything has just sort of dropped. I mean, he's working hard, but everything has dropped into his lap. And now, the rug's been yanked out from underneath him. And yet these experiences are training for him. They will help him as far as his being a greater warrior. They will help him in being king. And so God is working all these things. Now, consider this. David's got to do some serious logistics here, too. It isn't just leading the men. They are in the middle of nowhere. And he's got 400 men plus their wives and children. I've got to have some sort of a lodging for these people. Now, they're probably living in caves, living in tents. We have to have water for these people. This is a pretty desolate area. I've got to feed these people. Where am I going to find food to feed 1,000 people in this kind of territory? And granted, David knows this ground. This is where he shepherded sheep for years. But still, this is a hardship. This is great difficulty. And he's learning to live by faith. God is going to provide. And he is also learning. Remember, who came to him? Who are these 400 people?
The losers.
Thank you. All right. And he's got it. Because of his ability, he is transforming this group of losers into an amazing group of guys as far as fighting capacity, as far as unity, as far as prowess in their skills and so on. He's learning in discipline, leadership, and survival skills. And of course he's dealt with family and so on. So God has blessed and prospered in that area. Now I want to jump down. The rest of it doesn't deal with David, but I want to give you a quick survey of what goes on in the rest of chapter 22. Remember, David stopped at Nob. Now, Nob is where the tabernacle was at this time. This is where the altar was. This is where the Mosaic tabernacle was. This was a village of the priests. And evidently, that's all it was. It was not a large town. It didn't have walls necessarily. It was just a place where the tabernacle was set up, and the priests lived in the in that area. Now, remember, we had a guy named Doeg who was an Edomite, and he had seen David there at Nob. All right. He'd seen David there at Nob. And so he comes and he tells on David. He tells Saul. Because Saul is, let's look at chapter 22. Look at verse 6. And Saul heard that David was discovered, and the men that were with him. Now Saul abode in Gibeah, which is north of Jerusalem, in Ramah, having a spear in his hand, and all his servants were standing about him. And Saul said unto his servants, I love this. This will let you know what's going on in this guy's head. Saul said unto his servants that stood about him, hear ye now, ye Benjamites, will the son of Jesse give every one of you fields and vineyards and make you captains of thousands and captains of hundreds? I have authority. I can enrich you. I can empower you. That all of you have conspired against me. He's only thinking about self. All of you have conspired against me, and there's none that showeth me that my son has made a league with the son of Jesse. And there is none of you that is sorry for me or showeth me that my son hath stirred up my servant against me to lie in wait as it is this day. So he is deluded as far as thinking what Jonathan's doing. He's thinking that Jonathan is in cahoots with David to conspire to kill Saul. And he says, none of you feel sorry for me. You know, but the guy's king. What can you do? You know, we grouse and complain about our government. At least we have the right to change it every 4 years if we so choose. You know, it doesn't always turn out the way we like, but at least we have some say-so. You got a king, you're stuck with the guy until he dies. It may be decades. And he's got the authority. He doesn't have to deal with a parliament. He doesn't have to deal with Congress. He just does what he wants to do. And so we've got great corruption here. We've got wickedness going on here, and all of his soldiers know that, and none of the soldiers are stepping to the forefront and said, well, hey, I've got some information, because they know this is going on. They know that he's like this. And so, none of them is going to speak up, because none of them do feel sorry for him. And so he makes this little speech, and then Doeg speaks up and says, I saw David the son of Jesse at Nob, and he came to Ahimelech the son of Ahitub, and he inquired of the Lord for him and gave him food and gave him the sword of Goliath. That's what I saw. And so Saul sent to call Ahimelech the priest, the high priest. And he says, you've conspired against me, verse 13. And the priest says, David, your son-in-law, he came and he told me this, and I'm just doing my patriotic duty. And verse 16, the king said, thou shalt surely die, Ahimelech, thou and all thy father's house. And the king said unto the footmen that stood about him, turn and slay the priests of the Lord, because their hand is with David, and because they knew he fled and did not show me. But they wouldn't do it. They wouldn't do it. They would not obey the king in this matter. By the way, this is a good example of when you've got somebody over you that tells you to do something wrong, you don't obey. You do not do the wrong, even if somebody in authority tells you to do so. And so, who is going to step to the forefront and perpetrate the wickedness? Verse 18. And the king said to Doeg, kill the priests. And he did. He killed the priests, he killed their wives, he killed their children, he killed their livestock, he killed everything that had breath there in Nob. And one escaped. And his name is Abiathar, and we will see him again in the life of David because he becomes high priest. It says in verse 20, one of the sons of Ahimelech, the son of Abiathar, escaped and fled unto David. And Abiathar showed David, or told David, that Saul had slain the priest of the Lord. And David is just, I have inadvertently caused this. And so he tells Abiathar, abide with me, fear not. For he that seeketh my life, seeketh thy life. But with me thou shalt be in safeguard. I'll protect you. Because we have the same enemies. So, David is on the run. He has a confirmation in this horrific tragedy here. That Saul will stop at nothing. That even the priests of God and the tabernacle are not going to stop Saul from pursuing his wicked course. You know, sometimes we think that, oh, they'll reverence this or they'll respect this. They never will. Nothing stops the devil. If it is in his interest to kill and murder and betray and anything else. You know, you look at what goes around the world and you think, this doesn't make sense. Why do people pursue this to their own destruction? Give you an example. Why do the media, why do the people in the press, for example, support certain things that are going to limit their own rights? It doesn't make sense. And sin makes people stupid. It does. Sin makes people stupid. People pursuing a course of wickedness. We do this in our own lives. We justify all kinds of stuff. I could tell you innumerable stories of Christian people who do outrageous things. They follow a course of wickedness. They know this is wrong.
They use the word because.
Yeah, but. They will tell you the most amazing stories to justify their wickedness. They won't say, you know, I know the scripture says this and I know it's wrong. And they may even say that, but they'll say, but their circumstances are special. I'm an exception. But that isn't what the book says. People do the stupidest things in their pursuit of wickedness. And understand prior to our salvation, we weren't in our right minds to begin with. You know, this is why you look back at your pre-salvation days and you wonder, what in the world was I thinking? And then, even after we're saved, if we quench the Spirit of God and we pursue a course of wickedness, we are no longer led by the Spirit, we are led by our own flesh, our own desires. And we, knowing what we know now as believers, we lapse into that same mindless stupidity of sin. And we justify ourselves. And we pursue that course. And it's, sin makes us stupid. We do the screwiest things when we are in rebellion against God. There's a difference of opinion. I am strongly inclined to think that Saul actually was a believer. I'm actually in the minority on that, but I'm inclined to think he was.
He was
what? A believer. And I have several reasons for thinking that. And if you want to talk, we'll discuss that later on. But why do people do this? You'll see David doing some amazingly dumb things during the course of his life. And yet here's a man after God's own heart. And it's easy for us to judge and look down our noses at folks when we're not doing that. But I'll guarantee you, you don't have to look too far in your past, or if you could see the future, too far down the road to see us doing some of the same stupid stuff. Because we get tempted and then we do something. And until we recognize the sinfulness of our sin and confess it, we're not going to have a right relationship with God. This is one of the reasons why if you find yourself following that course, the longer you let that course go, the harder it is to get seemingly to get right with God. And then when you finally do get right with God, he says, oh, God, may this never happen again. And then it'll happen again. I've mentioned this before. Right now, my son's room is a disaster. Now, we're working on it incrementally. And we've been here before, and you guys had to deal with this, and maybe are dealing with this. Once it's clean, it is so much easier to maintain that than it is to start from scratch and get it all ready. Because we got to deal with that because we're having an open house on Thursday. Okay? Don't look in David's room. Actually, Aaron was working on the garage yesterday. Anyway. But anyway, it's easier to maintain than it is to fix. And we deal with that in our spiritual lives. It is so much easier to maintain fellowship with God and pursue the course of right than it is to rebel and pursue the course of the flesh and self-will and all the dumb things that we do and the hole that we dig ourselves. And then we got to, by the grace of God, he grants forgiveness, but then we got to deal with the temporal repercussions of all this. And so Saul has fallen into this, jumped into this, because of previous sin. He didn't obey God here. He didn't obey God here. He suffered consequences here. He suffered further consequences here. And now he's fighting tooth and nail to prevent those consequences from materializing. And he's digging his own hole deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. And that's the route of sin. Let's close in prayer. Father, we thank you for the warnings. Father, so often we learn from the bad examples of others. And Father, I pray that we would not have to go through the school of hard knocks ourselves. May we learn from the example of others. Father, may we learn, may we heed. And Father, keep us from pursuing the course of self-will and rebellion. We pray for Christ's sake. Amen.